Hi there, and welcome to another installment of In Summation, a podcast for curious listeners who want to know how and why some of the most notorious court cases ended up the way that they did. I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and today's topic is really interesting for a number of reasons. First, as opposed to the cases discussed in the first two episodes, this trial took place in federal court, so we're going to go into the difference between a state versus federal prosecution. And second, what separates this case from virtually every other case that we've talked about and will talk about is that the reason that people universally reviled today's subject is actually not for the behavior which got him into legal trouble. Both George Zimmerman and Casey Anthony continue to have large sections of the population who believe them to be murderers, and they face ongoing public judgment for the actions which led to their murder charges. Here, however, the behavior that led to outrage and vilification turned out to be more or less legal, and it was something completely different which resulted in an arrest. Today, we talk about Martin Shkreli, a.k.a. the Pharma Bro. In the future, on this podcast, I'm going to talk about some cases that happened in the past, before we were all born, and get away from the time period of around 2010 to 2015. But for right now, we're going to stay there, because what a crazy few years that was. Okay, on to Pharma Bro. Just hearing the name Martin Shkreli makes people cringe and shudder. But why is that? For those of us with hazy memories, Shkreli got spotlighted in the national media after his company, Turing Pharmaceuticals, acquired the rights to a drug called Daraprim in 2015. I promise we aren't going to go too far into the weeds on science. I'm a lawyer, after all. But essentially, Daraprim was a drug which many AIDS and HIV-positive patients took for a condition called toxoplasmosis. All you really need to know is that this was a drug that a lot of people relied on, there was no generic version available, and Martin Shkreli raised the price from $13.50 per pill to $750 per pill. That's more than a 5,000% increase. That made the news, and Shkreli was called a morally bankrupt sociopath, a scumbag, a garbage monster, and everything that is wrong with capitalism. But let's take a moment to do a little background on the man behind the scandal. Shkreli was born in Brooklyn, New York, on St. Patrick's Day, March 17, 1983. His parents were immigrants and worked as janitors. He had a very working-class upbringing. But he was exceptionally bright. He dropped out of high school his senior year because he obtained a Wall Street internship at the hedge fund of Cramer Berkowitz & Company. The Cramer in Cramer Berkowitz is Jim Cramer, the TV personality who dispenses financial advice followed by thousands of American investors. Through the internship, he received the credits required to graduate high school. He graduated Baruch College then at 21 years old with a degree in business administration. After 4 years working with Cramer Berkowitz, Shkreli had brief stints with Intrepid Capital Management and UBS Wealth Management before he started his first hedge fund, Elia Capital Management, and that was in 2006. He was just 23 years old at the time. Elia failed in 2007 when it was successfully sued by Lehman Brothers for failing to pay a rather sizable debt. Unfortunately for Lehman Brothers, it itself went under before it was able to collect on the judgment. Shkreli then started MSMB Capital Management in 2009 with his childhood friend Marek Bistek. He then raised funds from MSMB investors and created a subsidiary called Retrofin, which focused specifically on biotechnology companies who specialized in the treatment of rare diseases. He installed himself as CEO of Retrofin, and we'll talk more about Retrofin a little bit later because they become pretty important, but it's really critical at this point to understand how Shkreli was operating his hedge funds between 2009 and 2014. For a short while, he actually seems to be doing quite well. His colleagues and employees describe him as being whip smart and able to talk science seamlessly, despite having no background. He was described as a sponge for information, could recall every detail of every book he read. All of this sound like qualities that you would want in a CEO. But Shkreli was young, immature, and very reckless. He reportedly would blast gangster rap in his office, would anonymously tweet out the names of biotech companies he recommended to bet against to drive down their stock prices for his own benefit. In 2014, Retrofin actually threw him out of the company and later sued him for $65 million, claiming he was using Retrofin funds to pay back hedge fund investors when the MSMB funds went under. But before we get to that, let's take a look at what Shkreli is doing with these hedge funds. After Aaliyah Capital fails, Shkreli and Bistek form MSMB Capital. But while fundraising, Shkreli conveniently forgot to mention that he was still under a $2.3 million judgment from Lehman Brothers for his previously failed hedge fund, Aaliyah Capital. Unsurprisingly, he failed to mention that he had a previous hedge fund at all, which failed spectacularly due to poor trading decisions. The timeline here is rather important because a number of really important things all happen in a short time. So keeping the sequence of events straight is critical. I'm not going to get into the technical details of every aspect of what Shkreli did, but I'm going to provide, in basic layman's terms, the crux of his behavior, which landed him in hot water with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Department of Justice. The fundraising campaign took place between September 2009 and November 2010. The four investors in MSMB Capital initially pooled around $700,000 together. Shkreli told them the fund had around $35 million worth of assets. By the end of November 2010, Shkreli had lost the entirety of that $700,000, and MSMB Capital Brokerage's bank account had around $700 in it. But in December 2010, because Shkreli was representing that he had $35 million rather than merely $700,000, three new investors added another $1 million to the fund. Flush with the new cash, Shkreli unfortunately takes one big gamble involving the short sale of 11 million shares of Orexigen Therapeutics. And suddenly, MSMB Capital was in the hole for millions of dollars. Undeterred and still convinced of his own ability to fix the problem before anyone figured out he had lost all his investors' money and was essentially bankrupt, Shkreli contacted the investors and claimed the fund was posting profits of over 40%. Shkreli also apparently treated himself to more than the 1% management fee to which he was entitled. MSMB Capital then collapsed after the Orexigen disaster in February of 2011. Now, between February 2011 and November of 2012, Shkreli keeps painting a glowing picture of MSMB Capital's performance to the investors, even as the hedge fund had no money and had ceased all trading, and ultimately gets liquidated. But Shkreli is doing way more than sending out fabricated performance reviews. He's also actively soliciting investors for his next fund, MSMB Healthcare. Again, Shkreli conceals his past performance as a hedge fund manager, fails to disclose the failures of both Aaliyah Capital and MSMB Capital, and the debts he owes on both of those entities. MSMB Healthcare's fundraising is actually even more successful than MSMB Capital's was, and Shkreli manages to obtain about $5 million from 13 different investors. Immediately, Shkreli uses the money raised by MSMB Healthcare to pay off the MSMB Capital debt. To facilitate this repayment, Shkreli cooks the books for Retrofin, the company which is created as an MSMB subsidiary, and he uses Retrofin as the vehicle to transfer the money. Now, the transfer of funds through Retrofin occurs piecemeal, but begins in November 2012, right when Shkreli is forced to start paying back the MSMB Capital investors. Needless to say, neither MSMB Healthcare nor Retrofin investors are aware of or consent to this. And for some time, the Retrofin investors are kept in the dark about the money being siphoned off the company's books to pay for Shkreli's other debts. In September 2014, Retrofin's board, after learning about what happened, throws Shkreli out and replaces him as CEO. Now, around January 2015, so just a couple months later, the Department of Justice begins investigating Shkreli. This investigation is conducted by the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York and the Securities and Exchange Commission, or the SEC. They're looking into the claims made by Retrofin that Shkreli was actually committing fraud by misusing the funds. At the time, Shkreli, of course, had no idea he was being investigated, and in February 2015, he founds Turing Pharmaceuticals. In August 2015, so again, just a couple short months later, Turing Pharmaceuticals buys Daraprim. This is the drug utilized by a significant number of AIDS patients. The following month, September 2015, the price of the drug is increased from $13.50 to $750 per pill. Overnight, Shkreli becomes public enemy number one. He's 32 years old, stubborn, offensive, and completely oblivious as to why this move made so many people upset. And what really seemed to get people worked up about the situation was that Shkreli would constantly take interviews to defend his position. He claimed that most people who received the drug didn't pay for it anyway. And during one especially tone-deaf interview, he actually stated, quote, "If there was a company that was selling an Aston Martin at the price of a bicycle, and we buy that company and ask to charge Toyota prices, I don't think that should be a crime," end quote. Despite being vilified in print and on social media, in November 2015, Shkreli was still living large. He spent $2 million to win an auction for the Wu-Tang Clan's sole copy of the album Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. He had money to spend on whimsical items and didn't care how people felt about him. Everything comes crashing down December 17th, 2015. He gets raided by the FBI and arrested on a federal indictment from the Eastern District of New York. Let's take just a little time here to go through the difference between a federal case and a state case. Both George Zimmerman and Casey Anthony were prosecuted by the state of Florida. Each state has their own penal law or criminal statutes. There's a lot of overlap state to state, obviously. There are laws prohibiting murder, theft, and rape in every state. But each state has their own legislature which writes these laws, and they apply only to the state where the legislature passes them. Some states may criminalize behaviors that other states don't. For example, in a few states such as California, Washington, and Colorado, the state legislatures have effectively legalized, or at the very least decriminalized, marijuana, meaning it is not against the state laws to possess, sell, or smoke marijuana. In New York, these actions are still largely illegal. In addition to the individual state criminal codes, there is one overarching federal criminal code, which applies to the entire country. These criminal statutes are passed by the United States Congress and Senate and signed into law by the president. When a person breaks a state law, they're prosecuted by the state. These are the district attorneys or state attorney's offices. Each county in each state has their own prosecutor's office. State crimes committed in that county are prosecuted in that county. If you commit a crime at Yankee Stadium, the Bronx District Attorney's Office will handle the case because Yankee Stadium is in Bronx County. If an individual breaks a federal law, then they are prosecuted by the Department of Justice. Instead of the local police department handling the investigation, it's typically done by the FBI or the DEA or some other federal agency. The actual prosecution is handled by the United States Attorney's Offices. So similar to how each state is broken up into individual counties, the entire country is broken up into federal districts. Some states, like Massachusetts or New Jersey, are just one district. So the entire state comprises the District of Massachusetts or the District of New Jersey. But more populous states, such as New York or California, have multiple districts. For example, New York has four: the Northern, Southern, Eastern, and Western districts of New York. Each district has their own federal courthouse where these cases are heard, and the federal system has their own federal judges who hear the cases. Federal district court judges are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, as opposed to state court judges who are either elected by voters in their county or appointed by the mayor or governor in some cases. Now, a lot of these federal criminal codes do what the state codes cannot, which is to say they impose rules for what can or cannot be done across state lines. For example, they make it illegal to traffic drugs. The state of New York could not adequately prosecute a person for buying drugs in bulk in Florida and then selling a tiny amount on the streets of Manhattan. They would only be able to prosecute the small sale, but the federal government is able to prosecute all of it together because the actions all took place in the United States rather than the individual counties within the states. Another whole section of these federal laws governs the do's and don'ts of the financial sector. The laws covering financial frauds, Ponzi schemes, and other types of theft occurring in the financial industry. So, quick recap. There are state criminal laws and federal criminal laws. People who break state laws get prosecuted in state courts. Cases are the people of the state of wherever against criminal defendant. People who break federal laws are prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office for the federal district where the crime was alleged to have been committed. So the case is the United States of America against criminal defendant. If the CEO of a financial company were to commit fraud and steal money, they would be prosecuted by the corresponding United States Attorney's Office. Okay, now, with that crash course in federalism in mind, Martin Shkreli gets arrested in December 2015 by the FBI and charged in the Eastern District of New York, which includes Brooklyn, where he lives. He's charged with securities fraud and running a Ponzi scheme. The federal indictment alleged that Shkreli had defrauded multiple investors in his two hedge funds out of millions of dollars and then attempted to repay them with stocks and cash, which he illegally looted from Retrofin by way of his new hedge fund. In early 2016, Shkreli retains high-profile New York defense attorney Benjamin Brofman to represent him. Immediately, against his expensive lawyer's advice, Shkreli makes public statements claiming that he was being targeted by law enforcement because of the price hikes on Daraprim. There are certain situations where, shortly after an arrest is made and an attorney is retained, making a public statement can be beneficial. Sometimes a short denial of the charges and an affirmation of confidence that the truth will exonerate a criminal defendant can send the right message in the media. Brofman told Shkreli not to say anything, because this was not the case to make a public statement. The whole country was still furious with Shkreli for raising the price on a drug which many cancer and AIDS patients relied on to survive. There was simply no way that any public statement was going to garner any sympathy or cause anybody to feel sorry for him. But similar to his defense of the price increase itself, Shkreli just doesn't get it. Failing to generate any empathy, Shkreli then lashed out at the prosecutors. He insulted the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York, called them the junior varsity team, claiming they would always be in the shadow of the more prestigious Southern District of New York, which is headquartered in Manhattan. So now, it's early 2016, Shkreli is under federal indictment in the Eastern District of New York, and it's only been 4 months or so since his company, Turing Pharmaceuticals, raised the price of Daraprim. In February of that year, Shkreli gets subpoenaed to appear in front of Congress to answer to the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform and explain the price increase. This time, he actually follows Brofman's advice and takes the Fifth Amendment to every single question with the exception of confirming his name and identity. Now, what makes this whole situation so remarkable is that Shkreli is alleged to have defrauded the investors of MSMB Capital Management through malfeasance while he was the CEO of Retrofin. And this is where a lot of people get confused about the Shkreli situation. None of the charges he is facing even relate to Turing Pharmaceuticals or his role as CEO there. So Shkreli is actually being hauled in to get grilled by Congress on a matter completely unrelated to his federal prosecution. In a moment, we're going to examine the actual charges that Shkreli was indicted on. But first, it's important for everyone to understand that the SEC and the Department of Justice closely watch what financial institutions, such as hedge funds, represent to their investors, or how they act as stewards of investor cash. There are strict rules and criminal penalties associated with lying to investors to induce them to invest based on false information. Additionally, fund managers cannot lie to investors about the fund's performance in an effort to prevent them from withdrawing their money from the fund. Also, the money which the investors actually provide has to go to the purpose for which the fund manager claimed it would be. This is why Ponzi schemes are illegal. In a Ponzi scheme, the fund manager uses the incoming cash of new investors to pay out the obligations to older investors rather than paying them out of funds from the money generated by the investments made by the fund itself. We don't need to go into all the details of what you can or can't do with investor money. But suffice it to say that the SEC requires funds to be explicit in what they intend to do with that money, and if the money is being used for some other purpose, the fund managers may be investigated and arrested for securities fraud. So let's take a look at the actual charges Shkreli was indicted on and what the allegations were. First, Scheme 1. The Department of Justice claimed that Shkreli made material misrepresentations about the performance of MSMB Capital, the value of the assets it managed, and whether there was an independent auditor and administrator for the fund. In this scheme, prosecutors alleged Shkreli also prevented some investors from removing their money from the fund through other various lies. Scheme 2 was alleged to be identical to the first, only the purported victims were not the investors of MSMB Capital, but rather MSMB Healthcare, the third fund that Shkreli had formed after ILEA and MSMB Capital both went under. The third alleged scheme to defraud concerned Shkreli's role at Retrofin, where it was alleged he misappropriated Retrofin assets by transferring Retrofin shares to MSMB Capital and MSMB Healthcare in order to satisfy investor obligations. Overall, there were 8 individual charges related to these 3 schemes. These charges included securities fraud, mail fraud, and conspiracy. The judge who was assigned the case was the Honorable Kiyo Matsumoto. Jury selection in the case began the last week of June, in 2017, roughly a year and a half after Shkreli's arrest. Unlike most securities fraud cases, jury selection for Shkreli was exceptionally difficult because his name was so universally known and he was so publicly reviled. It took a full 3 days to find the 7 women and 5 men who claimed that they would be able to give him a fair trial. Over 250 prospective jurors were dismissed simply because they could not separate their preconceived views of Shkreli from the trial. Most federal juries are picked in 1 to 1.5 days, so the fact that jury selection took as long as it did is a real testimony to the mood of the general population, at least in the Eastern District of New York, toward Shkreli. The prosecutor, G. Karthik Srinivasan, delivered the opening statement for the U.S. Attorney's Office. He said exactly what you would expect based on what Shkreli was alleged to have done. He focused on Shkreli's lies, financial losses of the companies. He discussed the technical aspects of the frauds, the improper money transfers, alterations of documents, emails to investors with patently false information, various bank statements. In short, it was dull and boring, but it stated the facts the government intended to prove against Shkreli. Defense attorney Ben Brofman took the opposite approach. He knew that he was never going to be able to get Shkreli acquitted because a jury felt sympathy for him, or came to think he might not be such a bad guy. Brofman wanted the jury to like him instead. In his opening statement, he made it clear he knew and understood the perception of his client. He told the jury he agreed with them that Shkreli was strange and weird. He told them Shkreli clearly had flaws and a dysfunctional personality. Brofman called him obnoxious and outrageous. But he also told them that Shkreli was brilliant. Brofman quoted Lady Gaga, saying that Shkreli was just born this way. And he said that what Shkreli did, while unsettling, was capitalism at work, not criminal. Brofman used his opening to try and shift the focus onto Shkreli's lack of people skills, so that he ultimately could make the argument that the jury should not convict him simply for being unlikable. After he finished speaking, Shkreli actually hugged him in front of the jury before he sat down. Brofman also had a novel defense to the charges. When the average person thinks of someone who's been defrauded, they think of someone who has been tricked into voluntarily giving away their money to someone who then loses it. The two basic aspects of this are that the victim would not have given the money had they known what it was really being used for, and that they were actually financially damaged by it. Throughout the trial, Brofman consistently and continuously put forth the story that the investors in this case, the people who the prosecutors called victims of Shkreli's schemes, actually made money. Brofman called no witnesses during the 5-week trial. Presumably, not many people would have agreed to testify as character witnesses for a man labeled What's Wrong with Capitalism in America. Instead, he focused on the narrative that the investors here were not harmed, and thus there were no victims. Brofman was constantly eclipsed during the trial, however, by his own client, who seemed to have great difficulty keeping his mouth shut. He would routinely speak to the media during lunch breaks, claiming that he was being blamed for capitalism or just insulting the prosecutors. Shkreli's constant rants led Judge Matsumoto to issue a gag order not on Brofman, but on Shkreli, which is another highly unusual situation. Matsumoto claimed he had, quote, embarked on a campaign of disruption and had made a spectacle of himself and the trial directly on the courthouse grounds, end quote. Despite being prohibited from speaking directly to the press, Shkreli still shared his thoughts on his trial on Facebook Live and posted YouTube clips. Witness after witness was called by the prosecutors who recounted the lies he or she were told. They produced the emails and the reports which claimed significant earnings while the actual fund returns were in the negative. But on cross-examination, Brofman was routinely able to get the investors to admit that they had not been financially harmed by Shkreli. Most of the individuals who had invested were quite wealthy and had only given Shkreli a small fraction of their money, and, as it turns out, they were all actually paid back. There comes a point in every criminal trial where the judge will ask the defendant if he or she wants to testify or remain silent. 99% of the time, that question is met with a simple yes or no, probably followed by Your Honor or Judge, and either the defense will call the defendant to the stand or the trial will move on. Not here. Judge Matsumoto asked Shkreli if he was going to testify or elect to remain silent, and Shkreli responded, quote, plead the fifth when it comes to the fam, I'm like a dog, I don't speak, but I understand, end quote. Now, if that quote seems familiar, that's because it's a quote from Jay-Z's 2001 release, Never Change. And this outburst is really indicative of Shkreli's overall attitude toward the trial, which he never really seemed to take seriously, despite facing up to a potential 20 years in prison if he was convicted. Prosecutor Alexandra Smith gave the initial summation for the prosecution. If you recall from our past episodes, in federal trials, the prosecutor delivers a summation first, then the defense attorney, and then the prosecution is afforded a chance to rebut some of the defense attorney's points before the case is given to the jury. Smith's initial summation lasted a grueling 5 hours. Brafman's summation was much shorter. He stuck to his theory that when all was said and done, every single investor came out better than they were when they went in. Many people who followed the case remember Brafman famously crinkling a potato chip bag to make his point. Anyone could buy a bag of potato chips in the cafeteria, Brafman claimed, but it took hundreds of people working together to grow, transport, cut, fry, bag, and ship those chips out. Brafman was drawing a reference between the potato chip industry and Shkreli's work to build Retrofin from the ground up. The comparison was a little clunky, but it was memorable, which is often more important. On August 4th, 2017, the jury convicted Shkreli on only 3 of the 8 counts. Ultimately, he was found guilty of 2 securities fraud and 1 conspiracy to commit securities fraud charges. The case was then adjourned for sentencing. Initially, Shkreli was kept out on bail pending his sentencing date, but he then posted on Facebook that he would pay $5,000 for a strand of Hillary Clinton's hair. Judge Matsumoto perceived this as a solicitation to assault the former First Lady and presidential nominee, and consequently revoked his bail. Matsumoto sentenced Shkreli to 7 years in prison. He then went to a minimum security complex where he stayed relatively silent until this past April 2020, where he actually filed a motion for compassionate release. His argument was that his firm needed him to develop a cure for COVID. Matsumoto called this motion, quote, delusional self-aggrandizing behavior, end quote, and quickly denied his request. In summation, Brafman earned his fee on this case. Shkreli probably would have had a much easier time in all aspects of his criminal prosecution had he learned to be quiet, stay off social media, and keep a low profile, as Brafman told him. But that just isn't Martin Shkreli's style. The prosecution had the facts and the evidence and ultimately did get a conviction in the case, but they have to be a little disappointed that they only won on 3 out of the 8 counts, especially with the mountain of evidence showing Shkreli's lies and misrepresentations to investors. Personally, I think there's a decent chance that the jury at least partially bought into Brafman's argument that they shouldn't convict a person of fraud when everyone who he allegedly defrauded came out ahead. Something about that just feels a little bit off. But I also wouldn't be surprised if the countrywide disdain for Shkreli's business practices and personality had something to do with the conviction when all's said and done. Well, that wraps up the show on Martin Shkreli. It's amazing to see what people remember about these huge cases years later. Generally, people remember that he jacked up the price of a cancer and AIDS drug and was convicted and went to jail. And then they assume that the two things are related when in fact they really had nothing to do with each other. If you have any feedback about the show or even have a case you vaguely remember that you wish you knew a little bit more about, you can reach me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. That's insummationpodcast@gmail.com, or locate me through my firm's website, gottliebandjaney.com. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. I hope you enjoyed this In Summation podcast episode on Martin Shkreli, and thanks for stopping by.